Terry, you had some very interesting insights into Australia's history, in particular this age-old battle between Sydney and Melbourne.
Oh, well, it's very interesting you should say that. I'm a Sydney boy myself, so I'm perhaps a bit biased, but it is interesting that marvellous Melbourne at the turn of the century, when it became Australia's federal capital till 1927, was bigger than Sydney. But Sydney in 1906 moved to land value rating and abolished, under the Carruthers government, the taxation of buildings. And one of the avowed purposes of that was to get rid of slums and encourage people to improve their accommodation and improve the quality of buildings and get on with using the land. And that was what Sir Joseph Carruthers wanted. Well, over the succeeding century, guess what? Melbourne gradually lagged behind, and the progress accelerated in the 1950s as protection gradually came down, and Melbourne couldn't compete with its manufacturing, and while Sydney, however, had made things cheaper for people to build in.
Why on earth would Melburnians want to tax buildings, something that, we need? You know, why on earth would have they done that back in the early 1900s?
Well, it goes back to history, because the British rates system, which was introduced to replace what the poor relief that used to be provided for by the monasteries that Henry VIII abolished, the British rates system made the occupiers of residences in a parish liable to support the poor. And gradually these became the method of financing general local services. The way it was worked is they were based on the rental value of a property, and that the rental value of a property obviously reflected the building as well as the land. The idea was that the ratepayers in the municipality should take care of paying for the infrastructure, the streets, the poor, etc., etc. But the trouble with the system of taxing the occupier was what if there was no occupier? The most absurd case of this occurred in England in, I think it was the 1950s, when a gentleman bought some land, demolished the buildings and constructed a skyscraper, and chose not to let it at all for a couple of years while it appreciated in value. And at that time in England, there was no tax or local government charge on an unoccupied building. No occupier, no rate, no tax. At the same time, of course, at that time it was pre-capital gains tax in Britain, so there was no tax as a liability on the increment of value. So by keeping the building empty for 3 or 4 years while it appreciated in value, he paid nothing towards the services and public facilities that gave the building value, and ended up walking away with a very nice tax-free capital gain.
Way above the returns he probably would have earned on the share market at that time.
Well, he did very well, and it led to a change in the British law where they then changed it to impute a notional value. But, of course, Australia, as in some cases, was way ahead of Britain, because in New South Wales would move to the system of just taxing the land value back in 1906. And if the British had copied us, they would have been way ahead too. Mrs. Thatcher tried to reform rates in Britain and got fixated on the idea of a poll tax or community charge. Mm. Well, it cost her her job, but I remember sometime before that some British officials from the UK Cabinet Office were visiting us in Canberra when I was working for the government, and I did comment to them that anyone with a knowledge of UK history would not have suggested a poll tax, Prime Minister. And I did ask them why they didn't copy Sydney's system of local government rating, and it would do a far better job for London, but they said their boss had certain fixed ideas. They didn't serve her very well.
Now, back to Sydney, and the Sydney Harbour Bridge is one of Australia's focal points. Not many people know about how that was funded.
Well, the bridge is very interesting because back in the 1920s and 30s, people were a little smarter perhaps than they are now, and that was very easily realised that the bridge would add to the land values on both sides of the harbour. And so to finance it, and this is roughly, I think some of the money came from state Treasury funds as a public works, but I think about a third of it was paid for by rates on both sides of the harbour on the basis that land holders were going to get the benefit of increases in the value of their land due to the increased transportation facilities, and a third was financed by loans which were paid off by tolls, but of course the loans have long since been paid off and the tolls remain. But when you think about it, there's a very important lesson for us there. That if we tried to finance the Sydney Harbour Bridge today on a system of user pays financing, does anyone seriously think, if you look at the pictures of the Harbour Bridge in the 1930s when it was opened with a few Ford Model Ts toddling across it, does anyone think that the tolls from a few Ford Model Ts could have built that bridge? Of course they could never have paid for it, and nobody expected them to. Whereas to the models being now used for highways and toll roads, all the financing is predicated on the motorists financing the whole thing.
And how many years? We've got about 30, 40 years for our CityLink tunnel to pay it off.
Well, the joke is sometimes they get the calculations wrong, like the Sydney Cross City Tunnel was an abysmal failure. And we had the worst of both worlds. A large piece of expensive infrastructure was built, and then it turned out not being used because nobody could afford to pay for it. So it was a ridiculous white elephant, and basically a social deadweight loss because something that could be used wasn't being used.
And were there any stories about large property investors circling around like sharks when this tunnel was about to be announced? Were there any windfall gains there that perhaps Macquarie Bank benefited from?
Well, I don't know about that, but, but I'm sure there are always smart people who can look at the maps and see what's going where, but I think the problem has been that when governments have looked at private involvement of in infrastructure, they have assumed that the infrastructure must be financed by user charges on the apparent users. They have forgotten that the infrastructure should be financed not just by the users but all beneficiaries, and the dominant beneficiaries of fixed infrastructure are essentially the landholders. There's no reason why they couldn't enter into a consortium, say with Macquarie Bank or whoever, and say, well look, we are going to build railways or highways, and we are going to finance them with a private-public partnership, but this partnership will be financed by the power to levy a rate. And this was the way, for example, the Sydney Water Board used to finance itself. It would levy its own rates, but it was really in effect run just like the Melbourne Metropolitan Board of Works. It was really run as a ratepayer-funded cooperative. I mean, personally, my view is that you don't really need a public-private partnership in many of these things. You just have to recognise that the ratepayers are contributing towards something of mutual benefit, just like unit holders in a block of flats contribute to for the upkeep of lifts and stairwells. Well, why can't we all contribute by a rate system for our roads and railways and dams and water pipes? It's a very simple system. But so, and once you do that and you've contributed, you don't need to pay dividends to Macquarie Bank or to Treasuries.
Oh, hooray for that. I mean, we have to really look outside the square because our infrastructure deficit is just so huge throughout every municipality, throughout every state. You know, governments really must be scratching their heads, and we're hoping that they're going to look outside the square and perhaps take a leaf out of some of our Southeast Asian tiger economies. And I always laugh when people say that there's no such thing as a profitable train line. But what about the Japanese? What about, you know, the Hong Kong, Koreans? All of these people have funded a lot of their public infrastructure out of land values through what in modern day terms is called land value capture.
Well, that's a big issue. But first, before we start on that, let me say how appalling it has been for me to come to Melbourne to look at the so-called Garden State and look at the devastation done to the civic amenities, and look at the dead or half-dead trees everywhere. I was out at a park at Malvern, and it was built in the 1860s. Piped reticulated water was there in 1867, and now I'm looking at a dust bowl and a thing with blue-green algae in it, and you're thinking this is civic society is worse off in some ways than it was in the 1870s, and this is supposed to be a first world country where pensioners are running around carrying buckets of water, breaking their backs and adding no doubt to the cost of the national health system. So the decay of public infrastructure has real social and economic costs. But getting back to how you would finance it and how you could finance renewal, urban renewal and renewal of infrastructure, I think you're dead right. There is a long line of economic literature on the idea of land value capture and the idea that the beneficiaries of infrastructure can and should pay for it, that infrastructure generates beneficial externalities, and these can be recaptured because land naturally captures the externalities. Land is located near valuable infrastructure or useful infrastructure, obviously has a higher rental value than land further away from it. So there is a natural capture mechanism. I mean, after all, the word infrastructure means something stuck into or attached to land. By definition, it has something to do with land. You know, in the word infra means under. It's built in. So it's a spatial concept. But in terms of Hong Kong, traditionally Hong Kong, like Canberra, issued land on leasehold, but unlike Canberra, they were smart enough not to make them perpetual for long term for not much money, and they regularly increased the lease rentals. So Hong Kong was able to finance a large amount of public works, including public housing, through a budget that relied, up to the 60s and 70s at least, very, very heavily on land revenues.
Wow. So returning back to Melbourne to finish off, how did the squadocracy influence perhaps the way the ratings were developed in Victoria?
Well, I'm not sure of the historical details in Victoria compared to New South Wales, but people may be interested to know that Sir John Quick, one of the founding fathers of Federation, who was the MP for Bendigo in the Federal Parliament, wrote his doctoral thesis for Melbourne University on the history of land tenure in the colony of Victoria, and it was published about 1883, and there's a copy of it in the National Library, which I've read. And very early on, Sir John Quick, like many other people in Victoria, including the Victorian Land Tenure Reform League of 1872, had seen just how much of the most fertile land in Australia had been given away for a song to a small number of people, and they had realised that this effectively was dispossessing the people who came later. A policy of alienating land on a first-come, first-served principle inherently discriminates against those who are born or arrive later, and it engenders an inequality of wealth and opportunity, and confines people to crowded slums or whatever when they can't find a place to live. And there's a bit of a comparison between the feeling then and what we see now, when young marrieds, for example, can't afford to buy a house in the suburbs they grew up in or where their parents lived, because the unavailability of land through either lack of release or the large upfront developer charges or high taxes on building. I mean, housing, for example, was not much taxed until the GST. So this question of intergenerational inequality is a very serious issue, but it was one that was certainly recognised as a serious issue back in 1883 when Sir John Quick was writing his doctoral thesis, and it's a great pity it hasn't been reprinted. People could benefit from reading it in this city.
So there's a great simplification that could go on with government revenue raising. That's really the essence of what we're talking about here.
Well, essentially, yes. Look, I think Adam Smith pointed out, there's only three things you can tax: land, labour or capital. And Adam Smith thought that land was the best one to tax, and he commented that if you taxed capital or tried to tax capital, even then he realised globalisation existed. He realised that merchants could leave London and go to Paris or vice versa, and he was well aware of the mobility of capital, because many Protestant Huguenots had migrated to London after finding things inhospitable in France, and he was well aware of international commerce. I mean, globalization is not a new phenomenon, it's been around for a few hundred years. And so he said, no, don't tax capital. And he also, by the way, realized the civil liberties argument for not taxing capital. He commented that it would require a vexatious inquisition into every man's affairs. In other words, taxation of capital, of income, ultimately requires a police state, a Gestapo going through all your check butts and prying into your bank accounts without your knowledge, like AUSTRAC. For example, I believe there's about 2,000 public servants who have online access to your bank account and mine if they wish.
Really?
There's so much for privacy in this country. Well, Adam Smith saw that and rejected it, the far-seeing man 200 plus years ago. But he also realised that some people say, oh, why not tax labour? But he realised that if you tax labour, you are taxing a cost of production, because after all, labour has to be fed, housed, clothed and reproduced before it even starts being productive in a net economic sense. So he was against taxing at least the ordinary wages of labour. So he said, well, the obvious thing to tax is land, which is something that can't run away. So as I say to people, tax policy really is very simple. There's only three things you can tax: land, labour or capital, and only one of them can't run or stop breeding or working.
And I'm just about to take a photo of the 2008 tax law yearbooks, which are pretty much taller than me at 6'2", so it is just astronomical, the detail they're putting out there, and who knows how small businessmen are keeping up with it all. But thank you very much, Terry.